Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Michael Gordon Shapiro, and it's great to have a chance to catch up.
Likewise, it's great to be back on the show.
You know, the last time we talked, it was about your score for the real-time strategy game Empires Apart, and you've been really busy in the intervening time, and you've got a brand new soundtrack for the VR game that just was released, Down the Rabbit Hole by Cortopia Studios in Stockholm. And the game looks great, and your music is just amazing, so it's going to be a fun conversation.
You're very kind. Thank you.
It's the game is a prequel to Alice in Wonderland. And what's so funny is Wonderland was pretty messed up, apparently, even before Alice got there. So I'm wondering what the pitch was with the developers at Cortopia to get you excited and intrigued about doing the music for the game.
I was pretty excited just upon seeing it for a couple of reasons. One is, as you mentioned, it's a very imaginative premise. It's what happened before Alice arrived in Wonderland, which allowed Cortopia to bring in all the familiar characters from the Lewis Carroll mythology, the white rabbit, unless it's a hare, the caterpillar, the Cheshire cat, you know, the familiar gang is all back. But it gave them a little bit of a free hand in developing the story because you are playing a initially anonymous girl who is not Alice. And you've got a mission of your own, which is to find your pet Peaches, who has disappeared into Wonderland. And the premise is you're trying to locate her and rescue her. So you have a very rich environment, and but the mystery of a new story. So as soon as I saw this, I became excited. It's just a really fun environment and a fun premise to work with musically.
Yeah. So what were some of the initial ideas that you guys talked about for what direction to take the score?
Well, I had a long conversation with my immediate supervisor, who is Alex May of Moon Mode, which was the company that was subcontracted to do all the audio. So I sat down with Alex, who I'd worked for on a couple of other projects. And we put our heads together, and the idea is that we wanted to reflect two things, the mood and the spirit of the Wonderland universe, the kind of anarchic whimsy and the playfulness with a little bit of a dark edge that's endemic in both the original stories and this game. And, of course, always have the music feel appropriate for any particular level's mood and energy and just the physical action going on in gameplay. So those were the two columns that we were, I don't know where to go with this metaphor, we were trying to build under the roof of the score.
The orchestration that you settled on it's really perfect. It's like fantasy orchestration with strings and a piano and a celesta. And how much, I don't know, kind of experimentation did you have to do to get that to be the final mix?
I think this musical palette leapt to mind pretty quickly. And partially it's because the Alice in Wonderland mythology is so timeless and so part of our culture that it lends itself to, I think, an orchestral treatment very intuitively. The orchestra is still to this day the closest thing we have to a timeless universal language. Maybe solo piano feels that way as well, but the color and possibilities of orchestral textures are a really good match for a story that is so colorful and so full of imagination. The element I added perhaps to your standard storybook fantasy orchestration is a little hint of Baroque styles. There's some Baroque-like dance forms in the music. There's the obligatory use of the harpsichord to evoke the aristocracy and the queen and some of the buffoonery of the upper classes. So I think those were the two ingredients in the score in terms of the instrumental palette.
Yeah, I wanted to mention how much I enjoyed the cue in the soundtrack, the throne room, because it's absolutely spot on, perfect 18th century, really precise. I mean, Handel would have been really proud of you for for writing that.
Hopefully proud and not angry at plagiarism.
What were some of your favorite characters to bring to life with music?
The White Rabbit is fun because he is cantankerous and a little desperate. And his environment, and this is an addition of this game, is a series of hallways full of clocks. So there is both the sense of urgency that comes from this very neurotic character, as well as the relentless sound design of all the clocks ticking. And this is actually one case where the tempo of the music was very synchronized to that of the environment, because we had the music play at 60 BPM to feel like it was echoing the acoustics of the place.
Yeah, your cue, the clock room. I mean, I was watching gameplay of it, and it's absolutely spot on with the ticking. And what's so interesting about it is that that whole environment seems like a character as well. And so how closely did you work with the audio director to make sure that your music was going to dovetail with all of those sounds?
Very closely, and yet not at all. And what I mean by that is that this was Alex's brilliant idea. He said, let's make the music 60 BPM and it'll feel like it's part and parcel of the overall acoustic environment of the clock room. At the same time, we weren't sophisticated enough to be able to literally synchronize the music and the ticking of the clocks. You think that would be easy, but we couldn't do it, or time didn't permit it. So there is a temporal correspondence. Clocks are going at 60 BPM, music is going at 60 BPM, but the exact relationship is never quite the same. So it might feel that the music is maybe a dotted half note with respect to the ticking of the clock. So there's they're in lockstep, but an unpredictable lockstep, which is actually the kind of zaniness that makes sense for the game. So it worked out nicely.
Yeah, that is very, very cool. Thank you. things I was curious about, because this is a puzzle game. It's a virtual reality puzzle game. And so your music had to accommodate the length of time it might take for a player to figure out some of those clock puzzles. So as you were working on themes and the overarching sound of what a cue was going to be, you must have also had been thinking about how you could break it up and extend it with all the little stems, right?
Exactly. This is one of the Achilles' heels of the score. Every composer complains that there's not enough music in a game, and that's always true. But in this case, I would have liked to have had a little more than we actually were able to put into the game. So what I tried to do to accommodate this and to combat the sense of always hearing a melody all the time was to build in accompaniment passages into every cue. So typically the structure of a cue in this game is there's some sort of melodic idea that unravels over part of the cue, and then it settles into a vamp or groove for a little while. And that's just to let the cue breathe a bit and not constantly besiege you with melody. And to me, that felt like a good compromise given the modest dimensions of the score.
Well, it is a great compromise. And also, it's not intrusive. And as you're working out a puzzle, it doesn't make you feel like you're running out of time, really. I think one of the hazards that can happen, especially with a puzzle game, is you take too long and the music just sort of dries up. And then you're like, uh-oh, I took too long. So that was a really clever way to accommodate all of that time and, yeah, get a lot of more mileage out of the music as well. I wanted to ask you about your cue for the Cheshire Cat, because it starts with a clarinet. And I was just wondering if that was a reference to the cat in Peter and the Wolf.
How could it not be? I think that anyone who's listened to Peter and the Wolf has this unbreakable association between the clarinet and a cat, and the idea that one is agile and a little impish and playful. And I just went with that association. There was no way around it.
No, it's really, really a great fit. Through, you know, your music has this light touch, but yeah, there is a little bit of a darker edge and kind of shadows across it. And that's especially evident, I think, in the mirror realm. And so what's going on with that?
The mirror realm is one of the areas you visit as you explore Wonderland. And it's this beautiful and somewhat disquieting environment where the normal orientation and the inverted orientation of the landscape exist simultaneously. So in less fancy language, sometimes you're upside down, sometimes you're right side up. Sometimes the girl is in one orientation and her sentient card companion, 4.5, is sometimes walking upside down. There's a more surreal and less literal quality to this particular level. And this is one case where I wanted the music to feel a little more atmospheric and a little more surreal. So it departs. This is the one area where we depart from the neo-Baroque, neoclassical feel of most of the rest of the score and make it a little mysterious.
Yeah, and it almost sounds like the two lines of the piano are kind of mirroring each other as well. I mean, I was trying to picture my hands on the keyboard, and it was almost like they were doing a sort of a mirror image, a reflection in each hand, which is, I don't know, maybe not exactly right, but that's what it sounded like.
That's in the right ballpark. Another subtle way I tried to play with our sense of orientation is once or twice a chord will enter too early, meaning you'll hear the chord enter before the rest of the harmony matches that, almost like one hand got a little too excited or traveled through a very short time warp and arrived prematurely. And that was a neat effect. It's this brief little smidge of bitonality, but it helps create the otherworldly feel of the world itself.
Yeah. Oh, and I wanted to ask you about that kind of reverse sound that you put in there, too. I mean, in the olden days, a person would have done that by running the tape backwards and having everything just kind of disappear. But you've got that effect in there. So how did you accomplish that?
Well, it's not hard today to find all kinds of libraries, sample libraries, that offer you reverse timbre sounds. But being a little bit old school, I just rolled my own. I took a choral chorus and reversed it and then played with the envelope to make it seem like it was like a 1960s George Martin with the Beatles kind of effect, where voices and other effects were emerging somewhat strangely out of the void. And playing with that was another way of making the music parallel the disorientation of the visuals of this particular level.
It's a really, really cool effect, and it does sound like the sort of thing George Martin would have suggested to the Beatles all those years ago. One of the things that I also really enjoyed about it was your music for the caterpillar, the hookah-smoking caterpillar, because you've got a kind of an almost Middle Eastern sound with that one. So that must have been a fun cue to write.
It was a little too fun. And to be honest, I got carried away in the first draft. I was adding lots of Mid-Eastern strings and ney flute solos and lots of stuff. And fortunately, Alex very gently said, you know, this is a little busy for this moment, which is dialogue driven. Let's pull it back a bit. And as is the case so often, he was correct. So what we're hearing is a somewhat restrained version of my original concept. But it is fun to play with those exotic to us timbres and to throw them all together in a cauldron and come up with a kind of a surreal combination of ethnomusical sounds from different related cultures.
Yeah, and it's a nice departure. I mean, just a sort of a different moment where we get to hear music from other cultures too. That's one of the things that you did so well in Empires Apart, was being able to use that music from other cultures as you were playing the various factions and cultures and stuff. So it must have been fun during the process to kind of use, I don't know, those other sort of musical muscles, I guess.
It is a fun tool set to work with. As always, I try to step lightly to avoid caricature, because there's a fine line between trying to evoke a sense of a culture and sounding like you're parodying it. And in particular, when we have a character, the caterpillar, who almost seems like a parody to begin with, there's an art to not over-exaggerating that sense of cultural reference. So I do try to restrain myself when possible and give just a hint, just a dusting of another place without going 1940s Hollywood crazy evocation.
And sometimes that's all you need, too. It's like having a big spice cabinet and you just take out a little turmeric or harissa sauce and just mix it in, and that's all you need. You don't need to go the whole stretch. So
that's a far more sophisticated comparison than I would have made. So well done.
Well, thanks. How far in development was the game when you were brought in?
Trying to remember, because it was a couple of months ago. I would say it was about 70% of the way through. I was given gameplay videos to work with because the game wasn't really fully enough ready for me to jump in, and also I don't own an Oculus. So I was able to get a pretty good sense of gameplay from careful study of all the visuals and the playthroughs that they would send me.
Well, I really love the way the game looks. The palette is really saturated. It looks a little bit cartoony, which you'd kind of expect in Wonderland. And so those colors playing off each other, and then the dark shadows too, as the girl is going down these hallways, that must have given you a lot of inspiration.
The visuals of this game are absolutely one of its strengths. There is tremendous imagination in the artwork, and it's just a lot of fun to look upon. It's worth describing the visual interface to your listeners who obviously, in listening to this, won't have a visual in front of them. It's a VR game, first of all, so you have a kind of immersion that's distinctive to that modality of gameplay. But what's really creative is the approach to presenting the levels. The visual premise is that you, the observer, are climbing down a cylindrical rabbit hole, and you're using roots to climb up and down. They're sort of like your hand ladder. And if you can imagine the inner circumference of the cylinder, all the gameplay levels are taking place. It's almost like you're inside a wraparound dollhouse or an ant farm. And when you're moving your head, you're actually looking around the environment. So if you look up, you are looking up the rabbit hole, and you can see earlier levels above you. And you, as the invisible narrator, get to climb down along with the girl who you're observing and have this adventure with her with a kind of participation yourself. It's tricky to describe. It's easier to just suggest everyone go to YouTube and check it out. But it's visually very striking. And to bring it back to your question, it was very inspiring in terms of the music because the visuals were so much fun.
VR games are still sort of open, and nothing's been really nailed down with gameplay or visuals or even sound, because there's so many directions that studios are taking them in different, you know, gameplay mechanics. And I'm wondering what your thoughts were as you were doing the music for a VR game. Did you try to make it directional at all? Or I'm just wondering how you approached it.
My experience is that music is one of the least affected elements in the transition to VR. I think there are a lot of implications for sound design and the stylized way that you present 3D audio to the player with respect to sound design. But music has always been a sonic abstraction. It's been this stereo presence that follows us around and typically does not acknowledge our change of perspective. There are a few rare games where the music has a more diegetic quality and it's meant to be in the world in some way, and you're traversing a 3D world around you impacts how you hear the music. But those are definitely the exception. Those are much more experimental. And I think for most game experiences, the standard stereo, always in your ears, narrative music works best. So from my point of view, there wasn't a lot of adaptation that was necessary. I did try to be aware of the freedom that the player has to change their perspective and to know that they could be looking at any part of this level at any time. And for that reason, the music needed to evoke the spirit of the entire area rather than hyper-focus on a particular sub-region of the area, because you don't always know where the player is going to be looking. But even that is common to any modern game where you have a quasi-3D view of a world. So even that, I think, isn't drastically different in VR.
Oh, well, that must have made things a little bit more streamlined then, or at least keeping things in the comfort zone that you would have from writing the music for any other game. I'm just wondering what some of the really enjoyable aspects of writing this music were for you.
I think just working with familiar and beloved characters in a novel story was a real delight. I personally lean towards mythological subject matter, things that are a little wittier and lighthearted, and which may sound strange because I've scored a lot of games that are mostly about slaughter and burning down towns and typical gaming activities, but I really love something with a sense of humor and a sense of character and characters for whom we feel great affection. And this game had all of those elements, and as such, it was just a joy to work on. There was no cracking the whip on myself, getting myself to start working in the morning. It was always something I was looking forward to.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And it also sounds like you had such a great relationship with the audio director, and he wasn't really trying to micromanage you, so that must have been a big help too, and one of the other things that made it really enjoyable.
One of the advantages here is that Alex is himself a very capable composer, and thus he knows exactly how much guidance and creative freedom is beneficial to a composer. A little bit of structure direction is great, and then stepping back and letting the composer interpret in a way that they see fit. And Alex knows that because he's been in the same trenches as composer himself. So there's a particular joy in working with him.
Well, it must be nice, too. You know, music is one of those things that's really hard to talk about. And we do our best. But when you're trying to describe how you want a piece of music, a cue to sound or the style, it really gets pretty nebulous. So it must have been nice to talk to Alex, who knows kind of the terminology with a lot of the things that he was asking or suggesting.
I find it's most effective to speak in story terms rather than musical terms, unless there's some specific correction or adjustment. You know, if the tempo's wrong or the meter doesn't feel right or something like that, then yes, you can delve into the mechanical language of music theory, etc. But for big picture stuff, I would think, what's the mood of the story? What's the temperament? What's the balance between light and dark? All those gushy narrative terms that a storyteller would use in describing the story itself. I think that vocabulary is most useful in guiding the score.
Wow. Were there any surprises along the way? Things that came up or things that caused you to take your music in a different direction?
I think in this case, the initial vision matched where things ended up in the long run. And I think it's because the game is so stylistically well-defined that upon first glance, I kind of got it.
Wow, that's so cool. And the soundtrack is out now. It's available everywhere, every digital platform that a person could want. Do you have any further plans or like a vinyl or anything like that?
I can't imagine. What audience would want to buy a vinyl? I shouldn't demean eccentric tastes, being somebody of eccentric taste myself. I think the current release that's on CD Baby and Spotify and Apple Music and all the usual online storefronts is the best and likely final representation of the score outside the game. So I would encourage your listeners to check out the score there if you want to take a listen to it. And certainly if you're lucky enough to have a VR headset, to check out the game itself, because it's tremendous fun.
So how can they find it?
The URL for the game is downtherabbitholegame.com. And as you'd expect, that's one word. And it's available for, I believe, all the major VR headsets that are on the market today.
That's fantastic. And I think it's available through Steam too, right?
That's correct. And you can also get the score as an extra through Steam if you buy the game there.
Yeah, well, it's such a great package. And I think what's really interesting about it from a player's perspective is that, again, you know, it's just another way of creating a VR experience that's not a typical game. So just the whole package is just really wonderful. We've covered a lot of stuff, but Mike, is there anything that I missed that you'd like people to know about?
No, you're a very good poser of questions. You covered just about every angle I can imagine. So I thank you for that wonderful guidance through the discussion.
Oh, sure. Well, it was wonderful to catch up with you, and hopefully I'll have a chance to talk with you again before another 2 years go by.
I've got something cooking now that I hope to bring to your show in the not too far future. So hopefully this will not be our last chat in this year.
That's awesome.